So then establish this, this is the present moment, here and now, just to be the knower of the way it is. And then the body and the breath and the state of mind is like this. Now this is simple suggestions. This ways of integrating it into your daily life. It's wherever you are, it's here and now, and it's always now, and it's always here, and the body is like this, the breath is like this, and the state of mind is the way it is. And it's just this a kind of continuous reflection. It's like a reminding oneself, because the world, as we in Buddhism, the world doesn't mean like physical world necessarily, but the world we create. Like we think we all live in the same world, don't we? And assume that you and I live in the same world, but actually, in Buddhist terms, we are living in our own worlds. And so, you know, you think of the billions of human beings, each living in their own world, is an interesting way to look at it, rather than assuming we're all living in the same world. And what that means, when the Buddha talked about the end of the world, it wasn't like Armageddon, or, you know, that kind of total annihilation of the solar system, but it was the end of the world is here. And like Lungpa Cha would point to is citta, it's always here, the end of the world is here. These kind of gestures and reminders are very helpful, because the world does take us over. I mean, the world we create, our emotional hang-ups and views and opinions and tendencies and reactions to things kind of take us over, and we get kind of caught in this kind of whirling vortex of habits. And then as soon as you begin to see that, you know, you're kind of caught in this, then that point, that is the point of awakened pure awareness, you know. So it's just that it doesn't seem like much, because even the world of meditation, we create a kind of scenario of how meditation should be, and what good meditation is and bad meditation, and your meditation and so forth. So that it's the thinking mind is thinking. The thinking mind is a dualistic function of the mind. So when and of course one thought goes on to the next, so it's, you know, what they call conceptual proliferation or papancha. It just means you start with this, you get this impulse, and then the thought arises, and then the proliferation carries on from that stimulation, that stimulus. And so just trying to figure everything out and think and solve everything analytically, reasonably, logically, you know, it has its good side and function, but it is limited. It's not liberating to do that. You just wind yourself up more into complicated complication. So mindfulness then, of course, is the only way out of this trap. And it's always here and now, and it's not a conditioned state. It's not like a concentration, like a focused attention on something or other. It's just a simple moment of here and now, and then it's the sense of at this moment when you see it, when you're no longer just caught in the vortex of thoughts and proliferating tendencies and emotional habits. That's it. This is it. Just this simple attentiveness. And so it's like a poise, a kind of poised attitude of just receiving, receptive. It's a relaxed thing. It's not like you're pressuring, forcing, and it's not a willful act. It's just a sense of being present, very simple and open and receptive. So these kind of words help us get a kind of attitude that is most beneficial, you know, relaxed attention. Now, like attention, sometimes you think, you know, like in the military, you say attention, and then you're supposed to stop too, and you go contract and become very tense, you know. So, you know, in the military, in the army, you say attention, and you contract. You don't go. At least not in the military I was in. So, I mean, notice that it's like relaxed attention can sound almost like an oxymoron, kind of thing. It's like, how can you pay attention and relax at the same moment? And because we think of attention maybe as attention on something in particular, you know, like attention to the tape recorder, attention to the bowl or the book you're reading. But this is attentiveness, mindfulness, awareness, and so this sense of relaxed attention is a sense of it's a well-being attention. It's embracing. It's not divisive. It's not judgmental. It's not critical. It's just here and now, aware and receptive of everything at the moment. You know, so whether you're feeling good or bad, or you're feeling healthy or sickly or tired or rested or whatever your physical, mental, emotional state is, this mindfulness is willing to let it be the way it is. It's not saying, giving any kind of advice about how it should or shouldn't be. So the getting to recognize this state is the whole point. Like, once you recognize it, and then you cultivate this state of relaxed attention, being here and now, and in the present, and then you find that moment expands. It kind of self-sustains. You recognize it, then you begin to trust it, you know, it's something trustworthy. And then that's real pavana, or samaditi, samasangapo, is like the developing, cultivating the Eightfold Path or the Fourth Noble Truth. So that's why, just to keep remembering that no matter how much you get wound up or caught up into the world, the problems and personal problems that you have, that point where suddenly you just say, what am I doing? And suddenly you're paying attention. And then trust that moment. Don't go into the... Then we tend to, you know, on a personal level, we can easily get caught up in self-criticism. You know, saying, oh, I'm not mindful, I can't meditate, I'm hopeless, my mind wanders too much, I don't know. And then, you know, and then we can be very self-critical or discouraged because we get the ideas, and so when we have this moment of awakened attention, but it's ignored because it's not what we're really trusting in. We're trusting in maybe getting something more than that, you know, like some profound blissful state or something that, you know, that you would like or imagine or have had maybe some memory of at some previous time. So that's where the simplicity of just being, you know, using the body. Your own body is a focus. It's just you know, the feeling of just sitting or standing, walking, lying down. The ordinary postures, they're not, you know, like standing on your head or doing something fantastic, leaping in the air and you know, flying or anything. Just the most ordinary movements of your body through the day and night is you're either sitting, standing, walking, lying down. Of course, that implies a movement from one to the other, you know, from sitting to standing and on like that. So the body thing is, you know, taking it too personally and too, you know, dismissing it or making it more important than it is. It's something to use, you know, it's a container, it's a coarse condition, it's easy to observe. It limits us, you know, we're bound into, we have to live within the limitation of the human forms that we have. And then we begin to, you know, just appreciate that rather than ignore it or resent it or whatever reactions or vanities or tendencies you have in regards to your physical condition. Then the breath, and then the cittanupassana, the state of mind. Now Ajahn Chah was, you know, helped me a lot in the early years with this cittanupassana style, because I was, you know, had to deal with so many frustrating mental problems that I had to deal with. You know, how do you survive in a place in a foreign country where you can't speak the language and so forth, and a totally different way of life. You know, living within a monastic structure and different everything. So you're getting, you know, so many emotional reactions to it that I wouldn't be able to, if I was just trying to sort it out or just deal with it with trying to suppress or analyze myself, I don't think I could have survived. But because of this cittanupassana style, then I can actually observe my frustration or irritation or stubbornness, you know. It bring up, you know, a lot of rebelliousness in me, you know, because all this vinaya and everybody telling me what to do, and then, you know, you don't walk like that. I couldn't even walk right. And then my yam, they said I carried it like a weapon, like a club. They said, no, you've got to carry it on your arm, like a woman carries a purse. And things like sitting puppy up is excruciating. Every time I change, they say, no, they come on their back. And so, I resent a lot of anger, resentment, frustration, aversion, but also I could, you know, something in me, had this trust enough to be aware of it, of my own mental reactions, emotional reactions. And that I could do, you know, didn't take understanding of Thai language to do that. It's just kind of, you know, obvious that the way I'm feeling is like this. Also, like Ajahn Chah saw right at the beginning, he said, you know, you don't have any patience. Maimi kanti barami, pamoton, in Thai, you know. And it's true, you know, it must have been very obvious. I didn't realize I looked so impatient. You know, Americans were not brought up to be patient. That's the last thing everyone that ever tells you to be is patient. And so, you know, then living in this style demanded. I mean, otherwise, the only way to survive was through patience, endurance, and so I did that too. Just develop patience with myself and with the situation I was in. So this was, you know, like being thrown into the middle of the Pacific Ocean, sink or swim kind of experience. But this Jhātanupassana style I really appreciated because it really interested me. Because suddenly I was not just reacting and just being caught into my emotions without any perspective. I could actually begin to catch myself. You know, see what I'm doing, see what my, you know, the anguish or the grief I was creating in my own mind. Then I do a lot of reflecting, like, you know, like because of the stories about sweeping. Every day before one prayer, we spent hours every afternoon sweeping the ground, all this dust. And so I didn't particularly like doing this, but I felt, you know, I felt very intimidated, had to do it. And so I did it kind of because, it, you know, I was afraid of the reaction if I didn't do it. but I never, you know, I didn't bother to learn how to make a proper broom or anything, so I'd get one that had been nobody wanted, so usually a kind of worn out, you know, the brooms they make for sweeping, and you know, like rubbing a stick on the ground, you know, so actually it was a kind of miserable thing to be doing, and then we had to sweep even in behind all these trees, you know, it wasn't just the paths in those days, it was everything, you know, it seemed to last the whole afternoon in this dust. And so one day I was, you know, doing this, and I just kind of perfunctorily kind of doing it. And Lungpa Cha comes in, and so I'm coming, and he kind of gives this bright smile and says, "What Bapu is suffering, isn't it?" And walks on, and then I my first reaction is, "You got it right, sure is." And then suddenly I saw, no, it isn't. I'm making suffering around what I'm pulling. So you begin to, you know, just tune in a way that, you know, I was creating suffering around the sweeping. The sweeping actually wasn't suffering. It is what it is, you know, but not wanting to do it and then doing it out of fear of what others might think if I didn't, that's the suffering I create. That's my creation. And you know, that, and begin to know the difference, just maybe the discomfort of the heat and the dust and maybe you're tired and so forth. So that's just natural dukkha from being born in the body, but the suffering that of the First Noble Truth was, you know, the stuff I create around it. So then I began to have this insight that actually sweeping is not suffering. It's my not wanting to do it is the dukkha. So once that insight, I had that insight, then I started taking an interest in the sweeping. I learned how to make a nice broom with a lot of spring in it, so you get these wide, kind of lovely strokes, and the leaves just kind of go like this, and you got this nice spring in it, so it's not like scratching the ground with a stick. You actually, you know, I found it kind of quite a pleasant thing to do actually when the attitude changed from just doing it, or resenting doing it, or doing it to get it over with, you know. Let's, well, do this, get it over with so I can really meditate. But it was, it was itself, here and now, attitude was, you know, I saw through the suffering, the person, the resistance and the aversion that I had towards it, let go of that, and then it is, you know, just, you know, even could enjoy it, and take an interest in what I'm doing, even if, you know, like making a broom, a very primitive kind of broom they make, you know, with the tan, what, strips, you know, very natural kind of conditions. And just, you know, so this is like Cittanupassana, actually, you know, where say, it's not Cittanupassana if you're just looking and criticizing yourself. It's not, you know, because you can look at yourself and think, oh, I'm such a stubborn so-and-so, or, you know, lazy, or, you know, way we can look at our minds or state of mind, and then if it's a, you know, we can be critical of this. I shouldn't feel like this. I should be grateful. I shouldn't be so selfish or vain, and I should be more compassionate. That's not it. It's just observing the reality of the mood you're in is like this. And you begin to just notice the things around, is that suffering? Is that making me suffer? Can I blame my suffering on the mosquitoes or on the climate or on somebody else? That kind of suffering, that's not the noble truth. That's just the conditioned realm in its process of changing that I have no control over. But in terms of the suffering in the, like the first noble truth, isn't about hot weather and mosquitoes biting you or being sick, but it's about, not wanting that, not wanting to, if you're sick and weak, not wanting it to be like this is suffering. If you, you know, what, if you, even when you find something you really like, you know, you're really happy with something, and then you want to keep it, and you want it to hold on to it, that's suffering. So even enjoying something pleasant can be a form of suffering, because along with that, if there's not mindfulness or wisdom, then there's always the added of wanting to have it again when it's gone, or resent anything where, you know, that takes it away from you, takes what you like away from you. You feel angry, or even when it's completely yours, there's still the tendency to worry about losing it. I had another interesting, really powerful moment one time in Rome, in Italy. I used to give retreats there, and they have a very good Vipassana group in Rome, Corrado Pensa, and he'd invite me to give retreats. So there was one of his students who I knew, he's a lecturer at the University of Naples, and he very nice man, became very good friends, and he told me one day, he said, Ajahn Sumedho, you know, I'm the luckiest man in the world. He said, I love my job, have the most wonderful wife, beautiful wife, had a very beautiful wife, have good health, and I have this lovely daughter. Everything is just perfect right now in my life. But I'm worried because I know it's not going to stay this way. It's a good reflection, you know, like even at the peak of success and pleasure and that. If there's not awareness, if there's not wisdom, then even that can be a form of suffering, fear of losing, of changing, of loss. So, you know, like here at this time in the Ngan for Ajahn Chah, you know, this is a time where many of the, you know, disciples come together. So there's this kind of joy at meeting, coming together. And then there's the God itself and going there and listening. Many of you can't really enjoy it that much because of the language. Everything's in Isan dialect or Thai. But still, you know, you can be aware of your jit, of your jitta. And that's the real practice, you know, whether how much you understand the language or the teachings that are being given or your own reactions to the kind of lots of people and different ajahns and different. Then of course we all get together and have various opinions and views that we dump on each other, and our gripes and complaints and so forth. So this affects, you know, the state of mind we're in. And so like when people, you know, complain a lot and blame a lot, then that has its effect on the people having to listen, as well as the person involved. And so this is this is where the samana life, really getting back to just the simplicity of it. What are we here for? Is like we've got, you know, the four requisites, shelter for the night, we had our meal today, we have something to wear, and medicine for illness. And then that's perfect. So then we've got this moment right now, we've had our meal for the day. We've got a shelter to protect us from the sun and the rain. Got a robe to wear. And we've got all kinds of medicines. And so then this brings us in the state of, this is the life of a samana, of gratitude for the requisites offered. Because we don't. You know, they're offered to us so that we can do this kind of practice, this kind of mindfulness practice. So that's our, you know, that's our profession really, is mindfulness. And then, and that's our, you know, that what the point of this life is about. And then the conflicts we have with each other, our personal views and opinions, we can be aware of, you know, like attachment to opinions, to my opinion. Does that lead to peace and calm or joy or happiness? And so, you know, when you listen to monks giving forth opinions, and when you listen to yourself with your opinion, does that lead towards relinquishment and calm, or does it lead towards suffering? And so you keep asking yourself, you know, what am I grasping that I feel angry, upset, or miserable, or doubtful at this moment? What is it that I'm grasping? And so it's like inquiring and notice. Wanting something you don't have, not wanting things to be the way they are, and on like that. Like in the Sangha meetings, there's always issues and opinions. So you have, you know, the 14th, they'll have all these big ajahns meet here from the different. Of course, they'll have strong views about various. And so, Ajahn Kaylee, I advise you just to watch your jitta. Because, people have tendencies towards having very, you know, strong views about what's right or wrong or how things should or shouldn't be. It's not that that's wrong or anything, I'm not trying to put it down, but that's the way, you know, what we have to live with, in whether it's in monastic life or lay life or whatever. And so it's learning to use it. You know, that's our profession, that's our duty, to observe. We don't have to solve all the problems of the Sangha or the world or the country or the monastery or anything. We just, you know, we can, nothing can obstruct us from our, you know, our path, which is this way of mindfulness. So it's also, you know, like when, you know, like in my own life, just seeing how, you know, you hear all kinds of rumors, and you know, people are coming with all kinds of issues, and oh my God, I don't. Where can I run away to? And I have these friends in the Seychelles Islands. They've invited me there. I keep thinking, I'd like to go to the Seychelles rather than this God. But that is is suffering. So then, you know, before it even happens, I'm creating suffering over something that, you know, hasn't happened yet. And so noticing that, this dread, you know, that, oh, this issue, this problem, and then instead of doing that, then I try to practice a sense of welcoming suffering. So say, fill me with all the complaints, and I find that way I can kind of enjoy my life rather than get into this mode of, oh, not another problem again, or not another issue, and which is, you know, not wanting things to be like this is suffering. And so a lot of upayas, you know, you have to figure out for yourself, for your own kind of nature and character. You know, what I'm doing, I'm just sharing how I, what, you know, things that I've used, I've found helpful. But I think everyone, you know, because we're all quite different, have to, you know, develop our own skillful means. Upayas are like skillful means to deal with particular things. It isn't about meditation, like a meditation technique that's going to work for everybody should be doing. But Lungpon Chan was always praising like good upayas, you know, so you see kind of where you fall apart, where your weak point is, your Achilles heel, the place that really triggers off where you lose it. Then you take an interest in that and find out way of just learning, you know, how to deal, whether you need to, what to do with it, or how to relate to it, and that then it, you know, you're actually using your calming, Nipaka Kama, in the present, it's way of developing the path. It becomes path knowledge rather than just your personal obstruction or problems that are holding you back, and the way that we can interpret everything in a highly personal, critical way. So I offer this as a reflection for the day.